An 18-year-old boy, the son of miners, struggles to escape from that difficult way of life. An old woman, descended from generations of lighthouse keepers, fights to stay sane while living alone in her family's island home. A man who works as a teacher in a university can't suppress memories of growing up as a fisherman's son. This clash of the old ways with the new is a defining element in a new book by Canadian writer Alistair MacLeod, Island, The Complete Stories, which is published by W.W. Norton. In a recent review, the New York Times called Mr. MacLeod a great writer whose talent needs no hype. Mr. MacLeod also published a novel in 1999, No Great Mischief, which was a bestseller in Canada and won the Trillium Prize. On top of that, he was recently recognized by the Modern Library for having written one of the 200 best English language novels since 1950. It is my great honor to have Alistair MacLeod join me now on New York & Company to discuss his life and work with us. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
The 16 stories that make up Island were all originally published in two earlier books, weren't they?
14 of them were, and a story called Island, the title story, and a story called Clearance is the last story, were not published in the original two volumes.
So even if people have those wonderful books, which I suspect have gone out of print by now.
Well, there's an organization in Canada called New Canadian Library, and it's an offshoot of the publishing house of McLellan Stewart, and this publishing house is dedicated to keeping what they call Canadian classics in print, so those books have been in print for a long time.
In Canada. Well, yes. Here in the United States, of course, we're grateful to Norton for doing this. Your stories, for the most part, are set on Cape Breton Island, which is part of the province of Nova Scotia, but it's separate from the mainland?
Yes, it is separate from the mainland, although now it's joined by a causeway, so you can drive there, which you could not do prior to, I believe, 1954.
Does that make the Cape Bretonites, if that's the word to use, different from other people from Nova Scotia who most Canadians consider different anyway?
I think that all people who live on islands consider themselves slightly different, and in the same way that you know that the Irish consider themselves different, or the people of Iceland or New Zealand or Australia, although I suppose those are continents. I think any population that's surrounded by water.
Well, Manhattan, of course. Well, the people in your stories live hard lives, steeped in poverty and constant physical labor, and they seem to be used to the presence of death in their lives. They also seem to have great, enormous broods of children to raise. Has it been that way always? Is it the same now as it was when you were a child there?
I think the families are smaller, and I think an economy that's based on the extractive industries, you know, has its ups and downs. And coal has declined, and coal is not very popular now as a heating source, as we know. But the basic occupations are still pretty much the same as they have been.
I was surprised when I read that you actually weren't born in Nova Scotia, but in Saskatchewan. But you were, by blood, a Cape Bretonite.
Yeah. I was born in Saskatchewan because my parents happened to be there at the time, and I was born during the Depression. But my parents were both from there, and my grandparents, my great-grandparents, and on. So they went back, and I went back with them.
And that was when you were 10?
Yes.
Which is an impressionable age. If you grow up anywhere from 10 on, you are part of that place.
Well, it certainly made an impression on me. I think because my parents were both from there, it was kind of you know, a homeland before I saw it, because this is where they wanted to be, and this is where they ended up being.
But now I understand you live in Windsor, Ontario, which is practically Detroit.
Practically Detroit, yes, although some would debate it. Windsor, Ontario is actually to the south of Detroit, which is a physical fact that nobody can really hear.
It's the southernmost part of Canada, isn't it?
It is the southernmost part of Canada.
So people have to drive south from Detroit to get into Canada. And they do function as twin cities.
To a large extent. The fact that Windsor is south of Detroit is an intellectual truth that nobody can grasp emotionally.
My guest on New York & Company is Alistair MacLeod, and there's a new collection of short stories called Island from W.W. Norton. As I said, you write in the stories about the laboring life, about miners and fishermen and lighthouse keepers. Did you feel a part of those kinds of lives when you were growing up? Were you separate? Were you an observer?
No, I don't think I was an observer at all. I think it was just the life that was given to me and the life that I lived. And I went through university by working in the mine. I paid my way through university as a miner and as a logger and, you know, doing those physical things.
So you, for a while, there was a possibility that you might very well live this kind of life, or did you always know that you'd eventually escape it and do something else?
Well, I always liked going to school, and I always liked to read, and I always liked to write and so on. But when I was working in the mine, I didn't mind that either. It was just what people did, and so I perhaps could have stayed there.
But do you think that because you were part of that, it helps you escape the noble savage syndrome, over-romanticizing characters of these sorts?
I think to a certain extent. I think there's, first of all, I think people who live physical lives, they live their lives differently than people who live, you know, the life of a radio announcer or a college professor.
Because that's why I don't have calluses on my hands.
Well, that's true, because I think people who live physical lives lay their bodies on the line every day. I think in some cases physical life may be rewarding, you know. I mean, you can be a football lineman and love your work, and mm-hmm. people may say to you, is this what you do every day? You go out in the mud and get battered around and you like it? The answer may be almost yes.
And these people too, do you think?
Some of them more than others, I think.
Because it is very hard.
It's
and
very
on
hard.
Some level, they must be asking themselves, why me? Why wasn't I born rich?
Or why wasn't I born somewhere else? I think that geography has a great influence on the kind of life that people live. You know,
it's a determinant on so many things?
To a certain extent, you know. So I think that if you are born, you know, in Wyoming, it's different than being born in Massachusetts, you know. You may have the water in one place, you may have the prairies in another, and it's just different.
There are also Gaelic terms in these stories. So in Cape Breton, Gaelic is still spoken?
It's still spoken. It's spoken now more and more by a declining elderly population. But it was the first language of my parents and my grandparents and my great-grandparents and my great-great-grandparents.
And that leads to this whole sense of the struggle between old and new, because there's always the pressure to abandon those old ways, isn't there?
Yes, I think so. I think if you're going to go forward into the world, you have to speak the dominant language. And, you know, in North America, the dominant language is English. And so there's always a tension. I think
that. Do you think that's why there is such a strong feeling about retaining French in Quebec?
I think
the fear that
yes.
people are going to be overwhelmed, swamped by the
yes.
the hegemony of English.
Yes, I think this is very, very, very much what's happening in Quebec. The tension is how can you keep your language and perhaps your religion and perhaps your songs and perhaps your music, and also you know, be on the internet and you know, mm-hmm. be part of 2001.
And avoid having a sense of loss for all the things that could have been or that once were.
Yes. I think that I go to Europe from time to time, and I think, you know, with globalization, there's a strong feeling in Europe that, you know, the identity of the Italians or the Norwegians or whoever they may be lost. I don't think that they all want to become, you know, kind of generic Europeans.
Your work could be called dark in one sense, so imbued with the presence of loss and pain and death. But your characters don't generally express feelings of anguish over their lot. In fact, it's quite the opposite, don't you think?
Well, I don't think I'm particularly dark. I think
the New York Times recently, a reviewer said that your stories have become palpably mellower over the years.
I'm not sure of that. But Ernest Hemingway said at one time that all stories end in death, so that if we follow, you know, each individual story to its conclusion, this is where it ends. So I don't think we should be sort of, you know, squeamish about that or anything like that.
But there is a difference as we become more modern and we talk, we live in this therapized society. The acceptance of death is less likely in many parts of the world. I mean, you speak to most people, they don't even think that they're going to die, even though they know they are.
They're deluding themselves. They're going to die. I hate to bring, you know, shocking news to anyone. But
so if you get nothing else out of this interview, Alistair MacLeod assures you you're going to die.
Lots of things will happen before that, before death.
Uh-huh. Is this something you think about for yourself or you think about for your characters?
Well, I like to think about it for my characters rather than myself. But, you know, I do have a will and all these things, you know, so I do anticipate that I'm probably, you know, not going to be here in 100 years hence.
Do you think that the people of Cape Breton will recognize themselves if they read these stories? Do they read these stories?
Yes, they do read these stories, and they respond very, very positively to them. And I'm very glad that they do, because you know, I'm not someone who you know, spiritually or emotionally feel myself separated from those people.
Do you base some of the stories on real people?
No, I don't. I don't.
So you don't run into that problem. You know, no. I really hated the way you described my mother in that story.
No, I think I'm accurate in terms of the landscape, because I do know the landscape and the weather and so on. But I try not to sort of write about my neighbors or, you know, people of that nature.
You do go back.
Yes, I do.
But is it still with you when you're in Windsor, a very different kind of place? It's almost like a suburban city. Mm. Is Cape Breton present all the time?
Yeah, it's with me every day of my life. I think I just carry it with me all the time. I think a lot of writers are like this, you know. The Irish writer James Joyce wrote Ulysses in Austria, but he was obviously carrying Ireland with him.
I've told this many times. Jose Donoso, the great Chilean writer, told me that when he was in exile in Spain, Santiago, Chile was very alive in him. And then when he was able to return after the fall of Pinochet, he said it was such a disappointment. It wasn't half as interesting as the place he'd remembered and been romanticizing in his books.
Yeah, I don't think I romanticize the place, but I think that there is something to the statement that, you know, absence does make the heart grow fonder.
Alistair MacLeod has written two volumes of short stories and one novel. He's recognized as one of Canada's most distinguished writers. His latest book is a collection of short stories. Some have been available before, but two have not. The book is called Island, The Complete Stories, published by Norton. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break here on New York & Company on AM 820 WNYC. We're back with Alistair MacLeod, who has been recognized as not only one of Canada's most distinguished writers, but chosen as one of the writers of the 200 best novels in the English language since 1950 by Modern Library. I think in Canada you probably rated even higher. You would be put in the top 50 or so.
Well,
but, you know, Canada, it's amazing how many good writers Canada has produced, considering the size of its population. Do you people hang out together? Do you and Alice Munro and Margaret Atwood and Mordecai Richler, Carol Shields, just go to lunch every so often?
Well, we don't go to lunch that often, because we're separated sometimes by thousands of miles. But although Canada is a big country geographically, and it's only has a population of 30 million, the writing community is fairly small, but we do know one another, so we do have lunch, you know, every 4 months or something like that.
Well, it may be small, but it's all-star. Since Island is a chronological collection of your stories written between 1971 and today, a reader can get a sense of how you've changed as a writer over the years. In looking them over, do you have that same sense of yourself?
No, I really don't. I think of all these stories as almost as I might think of my children, you know. I realize that when you have children, you know, you don't have them all at the same time. But
and some turn out to be a little more interesting than others.
Well, that's true.
Alas.
Maybe my analogy is not a very good one. But I do think of them each as individuals. And I find that some of the ones that I wrote long ago, meaning 25 years ago, that when I read them, they still kind of catch me unawares. And I'm still sort of very proud of them, I think, glad that they turned out so well.
But it seems to me your language has changed over the years. It's grown perhaps a little less poetic, a bit leaner.
I'm not sure if that's a good thing or a bad thing. You know? Maybe it's like the hair upon my head. There's less of it than there was a number of years ago, but I have to go with what I've got.
Well, do you ever think about that, about why a sentence turns out the way that it does? Is it something that just comes off of your fingertips?
It literally comes off of my fingertips, because I still write in longhand. I must be, you know, one of the few remaining dinosaurs who still does this. I write with ballpoint pen.
And ballpoint pen.
Ballpoint pen. And I write every sentence very carefully, and then I type it or take it to the word processor or whatever. And I think this has to do with my age, because I didn't learn to type till I was 25 or 26, and I always did my revisions on the page and then, transformed it to TypeScript.
Well, many writers have these little things that they must do in order to be able to write. I understand Hemingway had to have every pencil sharpened before he could get going, and Schiller, I think I read somewhere, had this box of apples in a closet, and he would open the door and sniff it before he could get going. So I assume that because you wrote longhand when you started, that you wouldn't even want to try any other approach.
That's correct. I think of writing with a ballpoint pen as a sort of tactile experience, and I think when I, confront the computer screen, it looks like someone else is writing it.
But there's also a school of thought that says that sentences are growing longer again as a result of the computer, although I know Faulkner didn't write with the aid of a computer, and he wrote page-long sentences.
That's right.
Joseph Conrad did, too.
I think it just depends on what you're like as an individual. There are studies out as well that say, writers who began with a ballpoint pen or the typewriter now write more poorly since they've gone to the computer. But I think it may just be because they're old.
Reviewers and critics invariably express amazement that your reputation is based on such a slender output, 16 short stories, one novel. Do you share their amazement?
Oh, no, I don't share their amazement at all, because I say these are my children.
But does it take you a long time to write each one?
It has taken me a fairly long time. But I like to think that I'm, doing good work. And I think that if you're building, the perfect little house or something, it's all right to take time rather than trying to slam it together. And I don't think of that as an apology.
On the other hand, if you had produced more work, perhaps Michael Ondaatje, who of course wrote The English Patient, wouldn't have had to say something like, Alistair MacLeod is one of the great undiscovered writers of our time. I'm not sure you are undiscovered, but I guess he's saying you're not as famous as the quality of your work would warrant.
Well, perhaps that's so. I used to be described about 30 years ago as one of the most promising writers of our time, and I was saying to my wife 3 or 4 years ago, pretty soon they'll be describing me as one of the most promising geriatric writers of our time.
So people still see you on the verge of this big breakthrough?
On the verge of something at age 60, yes.
Well, you did win Canada's Trillium Prize for No Great Mischief, novel of just a couple of years ago. But there was a snafu about it being nominated for another top prize, the Governor General's Prize, that made headlines all over Canada.
Yeah. I think that was a clerical error. I think that someone in the mailroom, put the wrong date on the book, and when it got to the to the jury, they thought the book was for next year or something like that. There was a great fuss about it, but I didn't cast myself off the highest building or anything.
Well, those awards do mean sales, although it was still a bestseller. The Booker, I know, will guarantee a major bestseller, and I think the Pulitzer does. Of course, the Nobel surely does.
Yeah. I think it's a type of advertising, and not to denigrate advertising, but I think if people know you're out there, they have a chance to have access to your work, and otherwise, you might just be reading your book under your bed and no one may know about it.
Is there, you've written more short stories than novels, so do you have a particular fondness for the form?
Well, I think that the short story, I think of it in kind of track and field terms, that it's sort of like a 100-yard dash or something. You can be very, very intense for a little while, whereas I think of the novel as, a marathon. You say, what am I going to be like in mile 24?
Norman Mailer said that when he was comparing writing fiction and nonfiction, he said writing fiction is like climbing a mountain, whereas writing nonfiction is kind of like cross-country skiing.
Well, that's a nice comparison.
Well, he was saying that fiction is harder to write than nonfiction.
Oh, I think so. I think that if you're writing nonfiction, your sources are perhaps outside yourself. But I think if you are writing fiction, if you're a creative or imaginative writer, you have to look inside yourself, and who knows what you may find or not find there.
Are you surprised sometimes? Are you shocked by things that come out when you're writing?
I think, as I said, the writer looks deep deeply within himself or herself, and you find things there that you are surprised to find, and you don't know how they got there. You know, it's osmosis, or they went into you somehow, and then when you go digging around, there they are.
We will dig around a little more after we take a little break here. My guest is Alistair MacLeod. His latest book, All of His Stories, under the title Island, published by W.W. Norton. We're back with Alistair MacLeod. All of his stories, 16 stories, have been put together in a new collection from Norton called Island, the complete stories. No matter what you, over all those years, have pretty much written about Cape Breton, can you imagine writing about a big city at some point?
No, no, I don't think so. I think that each writer or many writers have his or her own landscape, and I think, you know, that Faulkner had his own landscape and Ernest Hemingway had his own landscape.
But even Faulkner, once in a while.
Not very often.
Pylon. Yeah, some of the earlier novels.
Yeah, not the best ones. Not the best ones. I think that a writer looks within his or her heart, and I think that the writer decides, well, this is what I'll talk about. And I think that you have to care very deeply about what you write about, and this is what happens to me.
Can I ask you to read? We have very little time, but I would love for people to hear. I always think it's interesting to hear how a writer reads his or her own work. We have made the first story in this collection available at our website. Perhaps you can give us a little sense of how we should be reading it.
Well, I'll try. This is the first story. It's entitled The Boat. There are times even now when I awake at 4 o'clock in the morning with the terrible fear that I have overslept, when I imagine that my father is waiting for me in the room below the darkened stairs, or that the shore-bound men are tossing pebbles against my window while blowing their hands and stomping their feet impatiently on the frozen, steadfast earth. There are times when I am half out of bed and fumbling for socks and mumbling for words before I realize that I am foolishly alone, that no one waits at the base of the stairs, and no boat rides restlessly in the waters by the pier. At such times only the grey corpses on the overflowing ashtray beside my bed bear witness to the extinction of the latest spark and silently await the crushing out of the most recent of their fellows. And then, because I am afraid to be alone with death, I dress rapidly, make a great to-do about clearing my throat, turn on both faucets in the sink, and proceed to make loud splashing and effectual noises. Later I go out and walk the mile to the all-night restaurant.
Alistair MacLeod reading from the first story in his collection, Island, from W.W. Norton. That's The Boat, and that's 1968. I can see why you're proud of the early work. When you read it, do you ever think, gee, I would have changed that sentence?
No, not very often. I think because I work so slowly, I like to think before I let the stories get out of my hands that they're as good as I can possibly make them. And I think this story, it was written in 1968, it's very, very widely anthologized. It's been translated into 14 or 15 languages, and it's taught, you know, in 2001 all over the world. And so I'm very glad that I took the care that I did when I was creating it in 1968.
You also have worked all your life as a professor of creative writing. Right now you're at the University of Windsor in Canada, in Ontario. Do you encourage your students to write this way?
I encourage my students to be the very best that they can and to do the best they can with what they've been given. And I like to say that I like to tell them that if you do your very, very best, you will be fine in the end. This is hard in the modern world for some of them because they want to be rich in an hour, in a week, or in a year, or in a decade. But I think that I've become almost an example of my dictum, you know, that here I am very, very well received. And I must say, though, that I have earned most of my living as a university professor. So if you're out there trying to make your living by your pen or by your word processor, there are different pressures that are placed upon you.
Well, you would have had to have written different kinds of books to have been able to live off the books. Very few writers who work as carefully as you ever have that kind of success, because you're aiming at a different audience.
I think you're right, and I think the advantage, you know, the disadvantage of working as carefully and as slowly as I have been working is that you do not become rich overnight or over maybe decades. But the good news about it is that you can just do your very, very best, and you can just, you know, give your best effort to what you care about most,
and then hope that somebody doesn't make a typo in the mailing room.
Yes, one has to be careful.
It's been such a pleasure talking to you today. I really want to thank you for coming by. I know you don't normally visit New York, but do you think you'll be visiting us in the next millennium?
I hope so. I hope before the completion of the next millennium.
Alistair MacLeod's book, Island, The Complete Stories, a complete collection of his short stories, including two that have not been available in previous collections, is now published by Norton and has brought him to New York and Company today. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.